Welcome to the My Aggie Nation podcast. This week, we'll talk a little bit of A&M football, and we'll break down some of those odd Olympic sports that we've watched this week. But the home run of this week's coverage is an interview with Shireen Williams from the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, calling from Rio de Janeiro. So, let's get right into it. I'm going to do that behind-the-back, no-look pass to the man from the zone. Here is Zach Taylor.
What's up, guys? How's everybody doing? I guess we can go ahead and start talking a little Texas, fighting Texas Aggie football. Of course, fall camp has broken out. Two-a-days are currently in. And
just spontaneously broken out.
Yeah, just spontaneously. They just kind of showed up every now and then. But, we've gotten our first crack at a couple of the players. And, yeah, so that's how fall's been going.
Right, we are kind of getting a little bit better of a peek on what is going on out there at the practice fields, even though we don't get too much of a glimpse, just a little bit of the same stretching routines every day and a few individual drills. But I think a few things are taking shape. I think one of the biggest question marks that we had going into the season is what would the linebacking core look like? And I think that has solidified itself a little bit. It's just as far as who, the personnel. You're going to have Otara Alaka, and I still don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, and Sean Washington as your two guys out there. And I think that while it is a 4-3 defense, I think you're going to see Donovan Wilson playing that nickelback and taking up another one of those linebacker spots, making it a little bit more of a 4-2-5. And I think that is how they're going to roll with most of the snaps this year.
Well, that's what Kevin Sumlin has told us as far as what his defensive scheme is probably going to be this season, a 4-2-5. The safety position is what they're really strong at defensively, that and the defensive line. And so I think that makes perfect sense. The linebacking core, while they do have some talented guys, and Otara Alaka, as you mentioned, Sean Washington, those guys have had some serious injury troubles in the past. And so I think giving them help up top is a big thing. Also kind of limiting some of their reps and working with two linebackers as opposed to three or four, I think that will help the longevity that they have this season as well.
Right. I think another storyline we have coming out of this, because a lot of times we don't get to see a lot of stuff, so when something kind of happens in front of our eyes, it becomes a little bit bigger of a deal, and that is why is Justin Dunning not practicing? Because he left practice while we were out there with an apparent injury, and we've asked the past few days, haven't gotten a whole lot of information, but that is a little bit of a blow to the depth in that secondary if he isn't able to go for any extended period of time.
And that's huge. We've talked about that. You know, listening to Kevin Sumlin rave about Justin Dunning, how much better he looks. Well, not necessarily better, but bigger, which in football means better usually. You know, when you're looking at a guy that's really done some work in the offseason, was having a great fall camp, a guy that they really felt was going to be a big contributor, could still feel that way. We just don't know the severity of the injury as of right now. And every time we've asked Kevin Sumlin, we've asked Terry Joseph last night. Both times we got about the same answer. Still being evaluated. We'll find out in a couple of days. And so something to keep an eye on as we continue to go throughout this week. But Justin Dunning planning to be a big-time factor in that defense. And if they don't have him, you know, for however long he's going to be out, the defense could suffer.
Right. And then the other thing that stood out to me, at least, is this emergence of information on the fact that a lot of this offense is going to be based off of, or you'll see a lot of, a run-pass option, which is kind of a modern version of the triple option, if you will. It allows the quarterback to make a read on the defensive end and on the defensive secondary and zip a ball out to the flat if he needs to on a pass, or run what basically is a read option with the running back. And sometimes that can start with the read option, and then if the quarterback rolls out, he can actually dump a pass out to the flat to a wide receiver. He can look out there first. It just kind of depends on the play. But I think that if this was the idea that Noel Mazzoni brought in with him for this offense, it's really a good thing that they have a veteran quarterback in Trevor Knight, and that transfer that who has seen some action, who the game will be just a little bit slower than maybe a freshman or a sophomore, one a little bit more inexperienced guy, and that'll just flow a little bit better with him back there. It's a little bit interesting to watch. It's some of these plays are unlike some stuff that I've seen before in what, especially what they run in the SEC. So maybe that new little wrinkle will provide them a little bit of a spark that, at least at the beginning of the season, when they don't really have a book on some of these plays, might give them a little bit something on offense.
Yeah, I think so. And I'm really wondering how much Trevor Knight's going to be asked to pass this year. I have no doubt that he'll be throwing the ball around. That's Noel Mazzone's offense, plus he's got plenty of weapons at wide receiver. But you also wonder how much of the running game is going to be implemented. And Texas A&M, for the first time in, gosh, forever, has a real deep stable. And Clarence McKinney even talked about the stable of running backs he has is deeper than he ever remembers having. And so how many of those guys are going to get touches? How much are they going to spread the ball around in the backfield? And how much are they going to implement that running game? And what are the percentages going to be? That's something else I wonder, too. I wonder if it's going to be 60-40, if it's going to be 55-45. I really wonder, or 50-50 for that matter. What the offense is going to look like under Noel Mazzone. What are we going to see, not only from Trevor Knight, but from all those running backs? And how well will the offensive line, mind you, be able to adapt to the new offense as well as new offensive line coach Jim Turner?
Right, that offensive line, we've done these lovely little periscopes and Facebook Live videos. Zach jumped on with me after yesterday's practice to discuss that. And a lot of people want to know about this offensive line.
Yeah.
That seems to be, I think, my biggest question mark coming in was linebacker. It seems like offensive line might actually be what the people want out there.
Well, you look at when A&M was successful when they first entered the SEC with Johnny Manziel, and you look at the offensive line that he had, not for just that first season, which was tremendous, but the second season as well. You're talking about four first-round picks that were in there, along with Jarvis Harrison, who's also in the NFL. So you started out with five NFL linemen, and the fact that they were able to give him so much time, they were helped dictate that offensive side of the ball, and that's really what made A&M in the first couple of seasons with Johnny Manziel and under Kevin Sumlin. Since then, it's been lacking, and you've seen kind of a steady decline in that O-line, and you've seen the results, and it hasn't been the same kind of offensive team as it was. Now, the guy who really created that monster, that offensive line under Mike Sherman, was Jim Turner. And now that he's back, they're looking for a repeat. They're looking and hoping that he can find that spark again and recruiting the right guys and coaching the guys up enough to get them to play the way that everybody was used to seeing the offensive line at A&M play. Because without that, you look at overall, you know, Avery Genesee is a guy that played quite a bit. He's going to anchor that offensive line. Once you get past that, it's kind of hit or miss. I mean, you've got some guys, some younger guys that have had experience, but albeit it was pretty poor. Keaton Sutherland struggled last year. We'll just have to take a look. And Eric McCoy, I think, is really the engine that's going to help this car run. And whether or not he'll be able to adapt to life as a center under this offense is a big question mark as well.
Right. And so another question that we got from a lovely Periscope viewer last night that I think really sparked a good conversation between the two is it kind of raised a good point. Someone asked, will this A&M offense have 2,000-yard receivers? Because I think when you look at this wide receiver core, you think might be one of the most proven units other than maybe defensive end on this team. And so it could be easy to say that if Trevor Knight can, find that glimmer of light that was the Sugar Bowl a couple years ago and sling that ball around, it could be feasible. But do you think that they could have 2,000-yard receivers?
I don't think that's going to happen. If they threw the ball around enough, if they threw it around as much as, say, Texas Tech or Washington State, the lumpy offense that they're going to have, or Cliff Kingsbury, yeah, maybe, but they're not going to have 1,000-yard receivers. Frankly, I don't think they're going to throw the ball around that much. And when you look at Trevor Knight, you look over all his statistics, you know, the most yards that he's thrown for in a season is 2,300. And that came in 2014 when he started in 10 games or played in 10 games. So he hasn't even gotten to 3,000 yards in a season before. And automatically, you know, you're thinking that 2,000 of those yards are going to be split amongst two different receivers. Now, if they had two predominant receivers or dominant receivers, it might be one thing. But the fact that A&M has such great depth at wideout, and that they've got so many guys that they can spread the ball around. You know, when you're talking about 1,000-yard receivers, I think it'd be the two guys that can go deep, and Josh Reynolds as well as Christian Kirk. And then now you throw Speedy Noyle in there, and he seems to be back on track. You got Ricky Seals-Jones thrown in there. There are a lot of different chess pieces to play with with Trevor Knight and Noel Mazzoni. And so I think because of that, I don't think that there will be two guys that have 1,000 yards receiving.
Right. This group is talented and talented across the board and deep. I don't think you have two Corey Coleman's or Josh Doctson's or anything in that wide receiver group that is just somebody that you have to target for your own good. I think Christian Kirk is going to be a great wide receiver for them, but he doesn't have the size that those two kind of guys had that can go up and get balls and do all around wide receiving duties like those two guys could. But I argue too that the scheme, I don't think, is just going to merit 2,000 yard receivers, just because I think they're going to run the ball a lot. And I think that it's also with these kind of read offenses, you have to take what the defense is going to give you. And I don't think that the defense is going to want to play a game where they say, hey, let's play a Big 12 style game and just see if we can outshoot each other with deep balls. I think they're going to line up and say, you know, run the ball against us and let's see what you can do running the ball. We're not going to give you these deep passes or passes down the field. We want to see what you can do, because running the ball, while they did have a 1,000-yard rusher last year, it wasn't necessarily like it was a strong suit of theirs. I think most teams will line up and say, run the ball and let's see what you can do there.
Now, when you look at it overall, too, Texas A&M averaged 4.4 yards per carry. You look at a guy, you know who had the second most rushing yards out of anybody last year for Texas A&M?
Tell me, Zach.
It was Kyler Murray. Kyler Murray, who played in, now he did play in about 9 games, so he got plenty of time, albeit it was kind of in a mop-up role, except for a couple of starts against South Carolina and Western Carolina, and then against an Auburn. But he was second on the team in rushing yards with 401. The leading man, of course, was Trey Carson with over 1,200 yards. But I think with the, as we talked about, the depth at running back, you're going to have that spread around a lot more. And you look at it last year, too, when A&M was predominantly going to the air, Christian Kirk had a little over 1,000 yards receiving. Now, Josh Reynolds got pretty close. He had 907 total yards through the air. So it was close to two 1,000-yard receivers last season. But again, that was under Jake Spavital. That was a different offense. And I think A&M will utilize the run much, much more this year.
Real quick, from that super intelligent mind that you have, tell me how many rushing touchdowns A&M had last year.
Rushing touchdowns, 13. Meanwhile, their opponent had 19. And you look, that's another thing that we can talk about a little bit later, is the rushing defense for Texas A&M. And Terry Joseph even talked about that last night, how the secondary has to play a big role in that as well. But you look at it, on the opposite side, the opponents scored 19 touchdowns on the ground. They averaged 5 yards per carry. A&M only 13 touchdowns and 4.4 yards per carry.
The point I'm getting at a little bit too here is that you can average 4-5 yards a rush through the season, but if you're averaging one rushing touchdown a game, are you converting there?
Exactly.
I mean, you can run all up and down the field like Bo Jackson and Tecmo Bowl, but if you don't actually cross the goal line, I mean, what is that doing for you? And field goals don't win ball games in the Big 12 or in the SEC. So that'll be an interesting thing to see. Yes, there's a lot of conversation to have on the rushing defense, and I think that's a whole segment's worth, and we still have plenty of time before that season kicks off against UCLA. So stay tuned for next week or maybe the following on a real in-depth look on that rushing defense. But now we have to talk to the great Shireen Williams from the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, who is hotline blinging our phone from Rio de Janeiro. That's next.
Don't want to make sure that we'll be all that we can be, all that we can be. All we can be, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Welcome back to the My Aggie Nation podcast. Again, Zach Taylor, as well as Travis Brown along with you. And we are actually visiting with Shireen Williams, Fort Worth Star-Telegram, all the way down there in Rio. And Shireen, I guess the first question is, what's it been like? What's the experience been like?
Well, you know, for me, it's been really a good experience, and maybe my bar was set way low on this thing, but I've enjoyed it. And this is my 7th Olympics, and it's hard to rank them 1 to 7 because they're all special in so many different ways. But this one definitely has to rank right up there. It's been a really good Olympics. And as I wrote a couple days ago, for all the criticism that Rio has gotten off the court, off the field, off the whatever, this is going to go down as one of the greatest Olympics in history, and I mean for the performances that we've seen from Michael Phelps ending his career, the greatest swimmer ever, Simone Biles, just finished watching her win her fourth gold and her fifth medal, the greatest gymnast ever, and what Katie Ledecky did, and we saw a world record in the 400 by a South African, and we saw Usain Bolt, of course, three-peat, and probably going to three-peat in the 200 in the relay as well. So it's just so memorable for so many different things. And Simone Manuel, we didn't even mention what she's done as the first African-American female to win a gold medal. So just so many great performances here that it truly is really memorable. And I don't know that we'll ever see another Olympics like this one with so many of those great performers. We start the debate on who's the greatest ever when we've seen Biles, Bolt, and Phelps all in here in this 4 or 5 day period. And you can pick any one of them and make a case for them. And don't ask me who my favorite is, who I think the greatest is, because I don't know that I can decide. They're all great in each way, and I was fortunate enough to see all three of them perform multiple times, or will see multiple times with Bolt coming up with two more races. And it's unbelievable. Biggest, most memorable moments of my career with those three athletes.
Sure. That's setting the bar pretty high there. I think it's pretty conceivable for most people to understand what goes into covering any sporting event in America. You show up, you go to the press box, there's post-game interviews and whatnot. What is it like covering the Olympics? Because I'm sure there's a lot of differences from just the normal covering of a Cowboys game or something like that.
Yeah, well, first you start off with, it's 17 days here in a foreign country. And you're in a hotel room, and so from that standpoint, it's just different from the start. For instance, I didn't even have an event yesterday until Shelby Vaughn was scheduled to perform at 9:50 in discus qualifying last night. And of course, it was rain delayed and didn't even start till 10:20, so I had to kind of kill a day, and it's one of the few days that I only had one event to cover, because you sort of feel obligated to cover two or more events because you can.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a Super Bowl, that's what I tell people, if you have a bucket list of sporting events you want to go see, this one should be number one on your list, and there is no number two. I mean, if there is, it's Super Bowl, and it's way, way, way down the list. And I've covered 22 Super Bowls. That's way down the list. This is the seven Olympics for me, right, 1 through 7, is the best events I've ever covered in my life. It is a Super Bowl every single day for 17 days, and it's not just one Super Bowl a day. It's multiple Super Bowls a day. Like I said, to be able to see a Biles and a Phelps in the same day, a Biles and, which I did, a Biles and a Bolt in the same day. I mean, it's just incredible. You can't do that anywhere else. And to see two of the greatest in history in their sports on the same day is incredible. So, yeah, it's way different than covering it. It's an all-day deal. Today will be the first day that I get back to my hotel room before 2 a.m. It's been 2 a.m., 3 a.m. Everybody's talking about Ryan Lochte getting robbed at 3 a.m. Well, why was he out at 3 a.m.? Well, because of NBC, we have events here that have started at midnight. So everyone's out at 3 a.m. It's what you do. You work until 3 a.m. or later, and you go to bed every single night at 2 or 3 a.m. So this will be the first night I've gone to bed before 2 a.m. since the games started, and I'm really looking forward to that, because it is mentally and physically taxing. You don't eat meals because you're riding buses and you're going from event to event and riding and interviewing and all the things that go into it. So a lot of fun, but it is a lot of hard work too.
And that resume is pretty stout for Shereen over there with covering all kinds of different sporting events. So take that advice well, because she definitely has the resume to prove that she's covered a lot of things, and that advice comes from a great place on the Olympics. So with all the talk of what's going on in Rio and green pools and people getting held at gunpoint and all that stuff, what has your experience been like with the city?
Well, knock on wood. I don't have wood in front of me. I have metal right now, but I will knock on some wood when I'm done here. It has been a very good experience, and I haven't seen that side of Rio, fortunately. I guess we have seen the green pool, and yesterday, the winds were so high here, the security camera came down in Olympic Park, and we had some windows actually blown out of the main press center, the NPC, But, you know, it, otherwise it's been a very good Olympics for me, and I haven't seen that side of Rio. Of course, I haven't been much outside the Olympic bubble. I did go to Christ the Redeemer the day before the game started, but mostly I've been inside of that Olympic bubble. My hotel is about a five-minute bus ride down the street. I've walked it a couple times, about a 40-minute walk. I did not feel threatened. I wouldn't walk it at night, but certainly during the day, there's enough people out and all those kinds of things that, you feel relatively safe. There's a mall across the street. I'll walk that by myself during the day. I wouldn't do it at night. We may go over there and eat at Outback, of all things, tonight, and we'll walk over with some other riders, and you feel relatively safe. There are police everywhere you go. I mean, National Guard or whatever their version of National Guard is with the assault rifles are everywhere. So you do I feel relatively safe, but I'm not going to take any dumb chances either. And you know, like I said, I haven't been outside of that Olympic bubble a lot yet. I do plan on doing a little sightseeing at the end here before I head back home next week. So that would probably take a few more precautions when getting out in the public, especially with pickpockets and that sort of thing, which is so big here.
Visiting with the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, Shireen Williams. She's down in Rio de Janeiro covering the Olympics. And Shireen, we know that you're calling long distance. We won't keep you much longer. But real quick, as far as the crowds that you guys have had down there, I know that there's been some talk about maybe not as big of a crowd as they were expecting. Have you seen that?
Yeah, no question about it. I have yet to... Yeah, swimming, I take that back. Swimming is not a real big facility. I think most nights that thing was full. I was there for, I think, all but one night I went to swimming, and it was relatively full, but doesn't seat a lot of people. For the night Bolt ran was probably 75%, 80% full, and that seats right at 60,000. But otherwise, the venues have been pretty empty. I went and watched mixed doubles, which was two American teams against each other in tennis. I just went to watch. It was a beautiful day. Went to sit outside. I'm a way to go before I went to my first event that day on Sunday. I had gymnastics and then to watch Biles. And then I had track with Bolt after that. So I went to watch tennis, and literally the I don't know how many it seats, but it was maybe 5% full, maybe. I mean,
wow.
You could hear the players talking on the court, and I was in the upper deck in the press section, and you could hear almost every word they said out on the court because it was so quiet in there. And there have been several arenas like that. And even gymnastics, you know, today with Biles wrapping up with her fourth gold medal was not completely full. So, you know, I think a lot of people were scared away by with what we heard about the dangers here, and it is a dangerous place, no doubt about that. But, you know, streets of Chicago are pretty dangerous, too. So, I just think people were scared away and didn't show up in the numbers that they normally would for an Olympics. But they missed a great Olympics on the court, on the field, on the mat. It's just been incredible with the performances we've seen, and I think a lot of people are going to go home with a lot of great memories from this Olympics.
Well, we'll wrap it up with this. There's still plenty of Olympics to observe here heading through this kind of final stretch. What are you looking forward to the most here in these last few days of the Olympics?
Well, I guess seeing Bolt run again. He's obviously got the 200 and the relay left, and I'll definitely see the 200 again, and I'm going to go out and cover some women's golf tomorrow, which will kind of be a different deal, and it'll be during the day, which will be neat to be outside. It's been really nice. We sat outside and ate a hamburger a while ago, it's just it on nice days here, there's nothing better than wintertime in Brazil, you know, 70 degrees and just perfect, and that's kind of the way it was today, so I'm hoping it's that way tomorrow for a little golf and get to walk the course and see that. So that'll be fun too. And probably men's basketball. I haven't seen men's basketball play yet. I'm going to go watch them tomorrow night just to watch. I'm not going to write about it, but just to go watch that. And then I will be covering the gold medal game on Sunday, assuming they get there. They have not looked all that great so far, obviously. But so there's a lot left. You know, for us, it feels sort of like the end. And then we start thinking about it. We were walking back to the main press center today. We said, we've still got a week left. If we were covering a Super Bowl, we'd just be getting to the Super Bowl and just be starting that. So we got a long way to go, as you said, here, and got to find some energy and make this last week as memorable as the first couple weeks were.
We've talked a lot about Aggies down in Rio. This is another Aggie down in Rio, Shereen Williams of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. Thanks so much for giving us a call, and stay safe down there.
Thank you, guys.
Aggie Nation podcast. You know, last night, my Olympic watching
skills,
or well, just interest declined so much because you have, you know, our friend of the show, Maggie Malone, throwing and didn't qualify for the finals in her javelin throwing around 56 meters. So did not qualify. So that, you know, that ended a little bit of something I was interested in the Olympics. Then you have the USA women's sand volleyball team going out, which was another one of my must-see Olympic follows. But that's okay. And the reason why that's okay is because my just secret, but not so secret, favorite Olympic sport that I will drop everything to go watch is still going on, and that is team handball. And so I pose this question for our last segment. I want to get a little bit into this team handball talk and kind of talk about how great that is. But there's plenty of sports that go on in these Olympics that most fans don't watch or don't even know about every 4 years. Forget they even exist. And then all of a sudden, that the glory of that sport is on their TV and they go crazy and they want more of it. Zach, what have you seen? What do you watch every 4 years that is just must-see TV for you that you just forget about every 4 years?
I've seen a little water polo. I like, and like you're talking about handball, I mean, there are some similarities in that it's very much set up kind of like soccer. You got two teams going at it against each other, but I like it when they're in the pool. And so I've been watching a little water polo, a little women's water polo throughout the Summer Olympics.
Right. Even in that green water?
Yeah, even in the green water. I think that just kind of adds to it.
Kind of moat-ish.
Yeah, because you don't know if there's an alligator or something that's going to like bring down one of the competitors. So it really kind of adds that extra step, I think, to it.
I mean, Brazil, piranha, right?
Yeah, exactly. You can have some piranhas in there.
So, but for me, it's handball. I mean, you're talking about it. It's interesting. I think there's been some quotes out there that some handball coaches are saying if Team USA handball could get LeBron James In 6 months, he could be turned into a Olympic class handball player.
Handball champion.
Which I think that's a weak argument, because I think LeBron James, if you put him in any sport and he has 6 months, he could probably be a world class, insert the sport name, badminton, whatever, which is another, you know, Olympic sport we could delve into here in a second. But team handball, I'm telling you, I don't know why this hasn't taken off more in America, because it has everything. It is a running SportsCenter top 10 play after play, because you have everything that people like in sports. You have people crashing hard to the net like in basketball. That's like every basketball top 10 play. You have full contact violence, because as long as you're fronting somebody and holding your ground, you can basically, as long as you don't hit their arm, you can do kind of whatever you want to them. You have flying squirrel throwers who are just doing whatever they can to get this ball by the goalie, and it's high scoring. I mean, really and truly, if a goalie makes a stop, it's something to be celebrated, because just about every possession the ball goes in the net. But it's not easy. They're having to fly around and do what they can, and it's kind of like looking like watching a really, really solid second baseman turn a double play. I mean, it's intense. It is everything that Americans like about sport, all in one nice little package, and it is fun to watch.
Well, a lot of people think about handball, and they're thinking kind of like when you got two different people, and it's a little bit like
wall ball.
Yeah, like wall ball, or what's the other, racquetball?
Yeah,
it's a little bit like that, but you use your hand. Well, this isn't it. They even got dancing cheerleaders on here. We're watching some highlights. Yeah, when you're talking about...
Again, another thing that Americans love about
exactly,
their sport.
Exactly. If you had the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders out there, LeBron James was playing, it pretty much covers everything. And you had red, white, and blue uniforms. That's about as American as you can get. But it's also called European handball, and it's big over in Europe. The U.S. team, I don't even think is playing in the Olympics. I looked it over. We actually talked about this on a show that I help out on every now and then on News Talk 1620. We were talking about this the other morning, and the U.S. team, I don't think even is in Rio to compete. But it's something, it's very much like soccer, but as Travis was saying, you can use your hands, you throw the ball. So picture lacrosse, but without the lacrosse sticks.
Right. And you use like a size 3 soccer ball, yeah. Like a little kid's soccer ball.
Yeah, like kickball ball type deal. Well, not a kickball, but maybe
like a souvenir soccer ball.
Yeah, exactly. It's a little bit smaller than a soccer ball. You're able to palm it and throw it. And yeah, it's lacrosse, but these guys don't even wear pads or anything.
No, it's pretty full contact. Now, my love for the sport spawns back a little bit to my time in college. One of our intramural coordinators at my school was from Italy, I believe. And so for about 2 years of my college experience, we actually had team handball
really?
As an intramural sport. And I kid you not, we strategized through the year more for playing team handball than we did. We were all a bunch of athletes, me and my buddies. And, you know, we won a softball championship and we were all a bunch of baseball players. But we strategized more for team handball than we did any other intramural sport because it was just that much fun. It got intense. It was pretty full contact. And as you imagine, college intramural sports usually get pretty heated and full contact to begin with. So it was a lot of fun. But, man, it was pretty cool. And so to get that experience a little bit, to get to kind of feel one of those handballs and kind of get a feel for the sport, if it only catches on somewhere in the United States, it could be the next biggest growing sport because it's just so much fun and it's just so much high energy and it's aesthetically pleasing.
Well, I'm very intrigued in it. In that, can you get called for traveling or anything? How does that work?
Sure, you get in. Unlike basketball, you get 3 steps.
Okay,
and then you have to take a dribble. And there's also like a double dribble rule. It's called a dribble fault, I think, if you dribble twice in handball. But yeah, you get through. So there's a lot of fast breaks. You take 3 steps, bounce it once. You can take 3 more steps, and then you have to stop. But it encourages pace of play. You can't just stall. You can only hold the ball for about 3 seconds. And the ref holds the judgment that if you're just passing it around the arc and you're not really making any attempts to score, you know, maybe it's late in the game and you're trying to hold a narrow lead, they can just call it a turnover. The ref has to deem that you are making an effort to score. So it's really high paced and it's always moving towards the goal. There's a painted, it looks kind of like the 3-point line, but I believe it's 6 or 9 meters away from the goal, radius from the goal.
Because it's European, it has to be in meters.
Right, of course, with an RE at the end. and so you can't shoot from inside there, but as most shots, as you can see from highlights, most shots are a guy taking a couple steps and jumping into that painted area and making the throw while he's in the air.
So your feet can't be in it.
Your feet can't be in it, but your body can actually be as long as you're still in the air. So that's what kind of makes it kind of high action and pretty intense like that. But other than that, I mean, it's pretty self-explanatory. It kind of resembles a little bit of an Ultimate Frisbee game too because of how much passing is going around and guys are doing 3-man weaves and doing behind the back passes and flips and stuff like that. So if you haven't checked out team handball, give it a go. But
are they still competing in that right now? Or
believe the quarterfinals just happened, and this podcast is going up on Wednesday the 17th. So I think around then the quarterfinals were still happening. So we still have about 2 more rounds of play, but in the men's competition, that is. I'm not sure about the women's, but yeah, it's a pretty high action sport. I don't know. I mean, water polo, I think, is a little familiar around these parts. I know especially out in the West Coast, you might even have some high school or college water polo that goes on. I don't know, Zach. What else? What else have you seen this year that's a little unique or something that if you had the equipment and a few buddies, what would you want to try to
what
play
would
some,
I try to do? Some, I don't know if I'd try any of this stuff. I'm not
some,
that
some
athletic.
Pickup luge or something if you want to get a Winter Olympics.
Yeah, something like that. Well, Winter Olympics, it seems like there are a lot more, especially when you're talking about curling, because that's everybody's favorite.
Right. Ice shuffleboard.
Yeah. The Summer Olympics, I like to stay more inside or in the pool. So yeah, maybe might play a little bit of water polo, maybe.
Okay, what is the worst Olympic sport? Because if I tell you what, I respect all sports and the abilities of all these athletes, but if synchronized swimming or diving comes off the TV, I'm going to go try to find badminton. That's just my way of doing Olympics.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand diving. I think diving, I'm not as... I don't dislike it probably as much as you do. You know, it's like interpretive... What is it? Interpretive dance? Is that what it is? Or
like rhythmic gymnastics?
Yes, exactly. With the ribbons and stuff like that. I mean, I can appreciate the beauty of it. I can appreciate the athletic ability of it, but I don't want to watch it.
Yeah. I'm thinking rhythmic gymnastics might. You know what's another one that I think is a little bit more domestic, and you'll find people playing, especially kind of in the Northeast, I believe, but field hockey. That's kind of an interesting one to watch because there are some unique rules to it, and I think me as a pretty big ice hockey fan, it's interesting to see the similarities to that. But in reality, in watching it kind of as a whole, it resembles soccer a little bit more because it's a really big field.
Yeah, you put field hockey together, and yeah, as you were talking about, that's really popular in the Northeast along with lacrosse. Lacrosse never really has picked up much in Texas. I do know people who have played it in Texas, but it's one of those deals that's just never really gotten underway. But field hockey is big up in the Northeast, and I've never really watched a whole entire game of field hockey, but it's still pretty cool to watch every now and then.
I mean, it's pretty intense because if you have a penalty kind of in what would be the crease or the, you know, the heavy offensive zone, you get, like, what's it, in essence, a corner kick, but it's not completely in the corner. But it's so intense with how quickly that ball gets fired around and shot that all the defenders actually go behind the goal and put on face masks and extra gloves and extra, you know, body armor for that one play because that ball gets flying around. It could smack somebody in the face real hard.
Right.
They have no... So anytime you're having to put on extra body armor for a sport, that automatically makes it just, you know, a little bit better. But
that makes it number one in my book.
Right. So field hockey, you mentioned lacrosse, which I know is an Olympic sport. I actually did a story a couple of years ago just on high school sports and what's growing. Lacrosse is actually the fastest growing sport.
Is it really?
In America. And you'll be surprised at how many places now in Texas have it's not a UIL, a state sanctioned sport yet, but there's a lot of club teams. There's actually a state tournament for lacrosse in Texas for this kind of club teams that schools can sponsor. There's been a couple guys I know up in the Metroplex at Coppell High School. They have a pretty big lacrosse program there. A couple guys who played football who probably could have garnered football scholarships, I want to say 2 or 3 years ago, who actually, because of what they did on these club teams, got lacrosse scholarships and decided to go play lacrosse in college. So
yeah.
I think it's that's definitely a growing sport. That might be one that would be interesting to see if it has any traction in the Olympics in years to come, as I know they are, you know, adding sports back like baseball and softball for that 2020 games in Tokyo.
Yeah, adding sports, taking away sports. I wonder if they're going to bring golf back. We've talked about this before just because, you know, you tried it for the first time in how many years? 100-something years. And the top 5 players in the world don't go. It's kind of disappointing.
It will be interesting because I think a lot of the concerns with that had more to do with the Zika scare.
Right.
Than maybe, you know, whatever. So when we get to another part of the country, you know, barring any new outbreak of any kind of disease, I think that'll be really golf's time to shine in 2020.
Tokyo. Yeah, it'll be in Tokyo.
So hopefully you'll have the Jordan Spieth and the Rory McIlroy's and those kind of guys over there. But still a pretty competitive golf. I mean, you have a hole-in-one. You have eagles flying in all over the place.
Yeah. And Justin Rose isn't too shabby. I mean, Justin Rose is a pretty dang good player.
No, and if you look and hear these guys talk in some of these interviews, I mean, you got a group of guys who are still pretty highly ranked in the world, and they really cared.
Yeah.
You know, which is more to say than a lot of some of the basketball players you talk to or some of the soccer players or stuff like that. You want a group of people that want to go down there and will consider meddling in an Olympic event a lifetime achievement,
yeah,
kind of thing. You don't want some people that are just going down there saying, oh, I mean, this is cool and all, but I'd rather win the Masters or, you know, win this X, you know, the Byron Nelson or something like that. But, yeah. So, some good Olympic talk there. I believe the Olympics will be over by the next time we are sitting in the studio, or at least it'll be close to the end. So maybe we'll give a wrap. We surely will want to try to get Maggie Malone in here to talk a little bit about her performance out there, but more importantly about just what's going on down there. Because I don't know if you have checked out her Snapchat, which is at Maggie Malone 93. She's been pretty vocal about people giving her a follow if you want to follow her adventures. She's gotten to go to big fancy Nike houses, custom designed shoes, meet famous Olympians like Alex Morgan, and just kind of really get that cool travel experience along with performing. So hopefully she can come back and give us a little bit of insight into the inner workings of the Olympics, not necessarily what we see on TV. But we will be back next week with another edition of My Aggie Nation podcast. I'm sure we will get more into football because that football season is growing ever more imminent in our on the horizon, and we will break down maybe the end of the Olympics and move on into the fall of A&M sports, which is rapidly approaching. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you next week. For